I'm a slowly recovering Al-Anon. My name is Rick Jatuk. Hi, everybody. I live in Toronto, and my home group is the Richmond Hill Al-Anon Family Group. Okay, Richmond Hill, which is north of Toronto. I don't know very much, but I do know for a fact, based on my experience in getting here tonight, that I am meant to be here this evening. When Beth called me whenever ago, I got my book and said I was not supposed to be available this weekend. I was supposed to be in Saskatoon. I don't know what's better, Saskatoon or Omaha. But they last year, the conference lost money, so they were only bringing in local speakers, so they phoned up and said, sorry, we can't bring in. She says, well, I'm sorry to burst the bubble, but you're our second choice. And I said, well, given the fact that I wasn't the first choice, and B, I wasn't supposed to be free this weekend, and C, after phoning the airport yesterday, I didn't think I was really going to get here. All three of those things being what they are, here I am standing before you this evening. And I'm very grateful to be here. I have visited Omaha one time before, and it was a marvelous visit. I attended your Cornhusker convention a couple of summers ago, and came away from there incredibly impressed with the kind of recovery you have here in Omaha. You can clap about that. That's good. The thing that I was impressed with was, well, one, how you all look, because you all dress up. We don't dress up like this at home. But two, the things that I saw that was so respectful of people, and two, how enthusiastic you were about doing the deal, as my sponsor calls it. And so I really was genuinely excited to get an invitation to come and share with you here this evening. When I was here a few years ago, I kind of wanted to save some money, so I hunted around and found a place to stay, and the sponsor helped me out. So Dee and Carol opened up their home to me. I had never met Dee and Carol. Enjoyed meeting them for one night, and when I woke up the next morning, they were gone. And had left a key to their house for me, to this stranger from Toronto. And I'd like to thank them publicly for that. I'll give you the key back this evening after. But I would also like to say that if you'd like to do that again, my TV's broken at home, so if you want to lend me the key, I can maybe go over and get yours. My sponsor told me to do this. Every year, the first Wednesday of every year, February, of each year, I do an annual fifth step. In January, I do an annual inventory. It's not a four-step inventory. It's a tenth-step inventory. It's an inventory of the previous 365 days. Where have I been since my last one? And it's a great thing. I can tell you this, that I hate sitting down to do it. I hate doing all the steps. I'll tell you that right now. I hate them. I love what I get after I do them. But the sitting down to do the work, I hate it. But I love what I get. Except this time. Because as I was going into this, and I was very honest when I was doing it, my sponsor got up, went into another room, came back, and gave me this little item. This is a slug. I'll tell you how good my 10 step was. And she said, your assignment is to carry this around to you, with you to every meeting you go to remind you of how lazy you are in your recovery. Oh, kind and loving, gentle sponsor that she be. She did say that I didn't have to bring it to work, though. Thank you very much. How embarrassing that would be to carry this thing. It looks like a turd hanging around. But really, it's a slug. Great big slug. So I kind of put that there as a reminder that I need to take action if I'm going to get the reward. I don't like doing this, but I love the reward that I get. And as silly as this is, I keep it in my briefcase. every day when I, every time I open up the briefcase and I see the slug, it reminds me, Rick, do the deal. Don't just say the words. Take the actions. Good reminder. I don't give it back until she asks for it back either. Very interesting. I was at a conference after I did that 10th step, and there was a speaker there from your hometown, Scott B. He gave a great talk. I really enjoyed him very, very much. And the theme of this little convention was metamorphosis from cocoon to butterfly. And it reminded me of a story that a friend of mine had told me. She'd seen it on one of these Life channels or Science Channel or something, about how when the caterpillar spins the cocoon and lies dormant for a while, or what we think is dormant, but is actually very active. We just can't see it. And all of a sudden begins to emerge from the cocoon that if we attempt to break the cocoon to assist the butterfly to get out of the cocoon, the butterfly will fall to the ground and die. Because a necessary part of the butterfly's survival is the struggle to get out. And that is very apt for me in my program. That if anybody was to come along and try to do for me that which I absolutely must do myself, I will never find God. But if with your support and your love, you allow me to do the things that I have to do, I can emerge and find God. I think it's a great theme, one of the best themes I've ever seen. And so my emergence is carrying around a wooden slug. So with all that said and done, let's get into this little story here. I really have no memory of the time before alcoholism. Kind of like there's people you must know in your life, and you never really remember meeting them. They've simply always been there. And that's what alcoholism is like to me. There was never a time when anybody sat down and said, Rick, your father's an alcoholic. Your grandmother is an alcoholic. That was never said to me, but it is something that I have always known. My family name, Jatuk, it's actually pronounced Yachuk, is a Ukrainian name. Grandfather immigrated to Canada in the early 1900s, an illiterate immigrant looking for a new life, kind of escaping the communist regime. Came to Toronto and got a job working in a carpet factory. We have no connection with that side of the family. However, my grandmother, her name is McCulloch, from Glasgow, Harriet Ann McCulloch, and she's from one of 13 kids, and many of them came to Toronto, and through some fate, they met and had four children, and lo and behold, here we all are. I had a friend many years ago in Al-Anon who said if you take anybody's family tree and shake it, sure enough, at least one alcoholic will fall out. In my particular case, if you took that family tree and shook it, kind of run and duck. And they're from Scotland, and they drink their drink. And it was a funny thing, because it was kind of this mystique around the Scottish side of the family. And every once in a while, they'd visit, and they'd come over, and it was like this great clan gathering with a C. D, not a K. A clan gathering with a C, yeah. The McCulloch clan. And it was an exciting time. It was going to be a party. I really remember what those parties were like, and I was excited about that, because Uncle Bobby was going to come, and Aunt Nellie was going to come, and Grandma was going to come, and the cousins were going to come, and it was going to be fun. And in the beginning, it was fun. And they came in, and there was lots of loud laughing and telling of jokes, and as a young child, I was allowed to be there with them, and other cousins were there, and we were laughing, and it was fun. And then something just changed. And it was still loud, but there wasn't a lot of laughing anymore. And all of a sudden, we were asked to just go somewhere else. Go to another room. Kind of go upstairs. And the racket got a little louder, but it got frightening. And then all of a sudden, there was this explosion. And everybody left. And I was mystified by that. Because what happened? it was supposed to be so much fun, and after a little while it stopped being fun, and it just turned into a big fight. But being the Al-Anon that I am, I'd kind of forget about all that, and a little while later we'd have another clan gathering, and I'd be excited, and the same thing would happen. And Uncle Bobby would come, and Aunt Nellie would come, and there'd be lots of laughing and fun, and then it would twist again. It would be asked to go somewhere else, and once again, the fighting would start. And that was a mystery to me as a young child. You might be surprised to know I became a very nervous child, very anxious. I peed a lot. So I was in the bathroom. I was saying, nobody could get me there. I threw up all the time. And my mother was really worried. And so she took me to the doctor, and they gave me all kinds of tests. And after all the tests were done, the results came back all negative. And they said, Mrs. Chituk, we do not know what's wrong with your son. And so back home we went. And I still went to the bathroom all the time. I was still very anxious, and I was still very frightened, and I still threw up all the time. If they had to test for what was wrong with me, that could diagnose a disease called alcoholism, the family disease, the doctor would have had a different diagnosis for Mrs. Chituk about her son. Because you see, the very thing that nobody ever thought to ask was, does anybody drink in that home? You see, the answer to that was, absolutely. That's really all they did, it seemed. And the very thing for us, I know for us, for me, I believe for us, but I know for me, was that the very thing that affected me then became my own affliction as time went on. And I think that that's the necessary fact for those of us in Al-Anon to come to accept, as painful as that has been for me to accept, is that I was affected by alcoholism, and then I became afflicted with a disease called alcoholism, the family disease. A miracle happened around 1965. The International Convention of AA came to Toronto. My mother, through some divine intervention, managed to go there and was introduced, A, to Al-Anon, and B, to Alateen. And a couple of years later, they were holding an Alateen conference in Toronto, and they needed places for these Alateens to stay. And so into this rabidly active alcoholic home, my mom said, yeah, we'll take a few. And in they came. And it was an amazing thing to me, and I want to describe that to you, how amazing this was. I felt this peeing, throwing up little kid. Like all of us, didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. And into my house came three kids, three teenagers from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Seems so far away. Not as far as Nebraska, I'll tell you that. I could drive there. And this is what happened to me. I was 11 years old. And for the first time in my then young life, I simply felt that it was okay to be with those people. So the onlooker looking at me, it was totally unremarkable looking. But what happened inside me was absolutely remarkable. Because I felt okay to be there. And you know, here I am. I don't know how far away from home I am. And when I walked in here tonight, I felt the exact same thing. That it's okay to be here. As one of my brothers in sponsorship says, you are my people. And I feel comfortable when I am with my people, because we understand one another in a way that nobody else can understand. And that's what happened to me at 11 years old. And then I went, they said, hey, why don't you start going to Alateen? So that's what I did. I was 11 years old and I went. And I sat in this meeting, and this is what they said to me. He said, Rick, your father is an alcoholic. He is not a bad man. And I so desperately needed to hear that, because you see, I thought he was. But he wasn't. My father has a disease, and it's called alcoholism. And he is an alcoholic. He is not a bad man. And today, as I stand before you, a man of 43 years old, whose father was sober for 20 years, and a year and a half ago, drank again, I need to tell you this, that my father is an alcoholic. He is not a bad man. He has a disease called alcoholism, and it is cunning, it is powerful, it is baffling, and it is patient. and it's back. And I need that message I got as a young kid, I still need today as an adult. One thing they didn't say to me was, Rick, your mother has alcoholism and family disease. You don't need to feel that way about her. Because you know, my mother was crazy. Dad was real clear. He drank, he wanted to come, and he wanted to come home, he wanted to go to bed. Mom, I didn't know what was wrong with Mom. I was with Mom all the time. And I'd like to stand and say to you, and to the mothers in the room, this might disturb you. I have said it many times with my mother sitting where you are sitting, that the non-alcoholic in the home has as much effect, if not more, on the children as the alcoholic does. Because you see, we have alcoholism, the family disease. We are not bad people. We did not do that on purpose. That was not done on purpose. When a disease is alive and active in a home, that is not being done on purpose. It is a disease. And when it's blowing up, they're the things that happen in alcoholic environments. That's what goes on. As we come here, we start to learn that it's possible to change once we've accepted the fact that we have a disease. Dad was a right out front drinker. There was nothing secret at 5 Gage Avenue. My dad liked to drink beer. He liked to garden. And he liked to remove his clothes. And he would do them in that order. Now you know how hard it is to contain any kind of a drunk. A naked drunk is really difficult to hold back. And so there Dad would be. We had the loveliest garden on the street, I'll tell you that. And so he'd be out there on Saturday, and he'd kind of start early in the morning, and he'd start drinking the beer, and he'd have the clothes on, and it'd kind of get a little warmer, and kind of the shirt would come off, and then it'd come off, and then eventually, it was really like he took a pair of regular shorts and turned it into a thong, really. Just a sight, I'll tell you that. Oh, Dad, you see my mother, oh, Donald, I love you so much. There is the brown study bottle and the cigarette and the big belly and the shovel. What a vision that is. Out front for everybody to see. And every once in a while, somebody would do something in the street and he'd get pissed off because he had that alcoholic anger. Anybody understand that? Somebody drove their car too fast and he got mad. And he'd race after them with his thong and his cigarette and his beer to drop the shovel. And I have this vision. This image of us standing inside looking at this naked alcoholic screaming at somebody in the middle of the street making an ass of himself and us being inside feeling embarrassed. What's that about? He's the one out there, we can't show our face. Years later, when he got sober, he really got the double A good. He got put the stickers on the car and everything, the bumper stickers, you know, easy does it, you know, let go and let God. And one day my mother said to him, for God's sake, Donald, why do you have those bumper stickers in the car? Everybody's going to see them. I said, for crying out loud, Mom, they've seen everything else. They're going to see the stickers. Isn't that an amazing thing? They've seen this naked drunk, can't see the stickers. Every once in a while, they'd wake up in the morning and open their curtains, and the contents of our house would be in our front lawn. I wish I was making that up. Well, man, you can't see the stickers. But as crazy as all that stuff is, and you know, we can regale about. And you know, isn't it funny? We love to tell those stories. Love it. We can regale those stories for a long time. But the fact is, that there was a real effect about that. And thank God I had this program to get into it. And I was in Alateen. And you know, I can't say when I was in Alateen that I did a lot of program. I did what I could how are you going to make your powerless when you're 13? You're starting to feel power when you're 13. For God's sake! You know? Baseball, yeah! Like, I feel good. You're feeling it. Powerless? No, I don't think so. But what it did let me do, was have a fellowship of people who understood when I told them the kind of stories I'm telling you. Thank God I can laugh about them today, because it wasn't funny then. But it is funny today. Thank God I can laugh. But they understood. And I could share, and they could share their stuff with me. And there was an incredible power in that fellowship. And so whatever little program I did when I was in Alateen, the fellowship kind of got me through being a teenager. And it wasn't cool to drink. It wasn't cool to do drugs. It was cool to kind of go to your meeting on Thursday night and go to a conference whenever you could. It was an amazing thing, and it helped me out tremendously. I met people in Al-Anon, and I met people in AA, and I was kind of involved in this whole thing as a teenager. Dad got sober, and you know, every once in a while, we'd even share on one of these things together. It was a great thing. And then when I was turned 21, they kicked me out. Out of here, you're too old. Out you go. And what I was about to discover was that God had a lot more to do with me before I was really willing to do the deal in Al-Anon. When we do step one, when we admit that we are powerless over alcohol, zip, that our lives have become unmanageable, there's not two parts to that step. We all know that. The second half is simply an elaboration of the first. That's what the hyphen means. Admitting we're powerless, just saying unmanageable is another way to say that. Very same thing. When we do that step in Al-Anon, what does that mean? Well, in the beginning, it means when he drinks, absolutely you're powerless over that. He's crazy. I hate that. Things are unmanageable. But there's nothing wrong with me. How many people in Al-Anon really ever came into Al-Anon and said, my life is a mess. Help me. I don't know of many. How many people came into Al-Anon and said, how do I get this asshole to stop drinking? Put your hand. There you go. Be honest. Come on, honesty. That's right. That's why we came. That's why we come to Al-Anon. How do we get them to stop drinking and then I will be okay? And isn't that funny that we want to get them to stop drinking, not because we want them to be okay? We come to Al-Anon because we want to be okay. And we talk about the selfishness of the alcoholic. Let's take a look at the selfishness of the Al-Anon. It's all about us. Sponsor pointed it out to me one day after my dad started drinking again. I said, oh, God, I'm terrified. You know, he was an animal when he drank. And she said, Rick, what about him? Oh, I kind of forgot about him. I was just thinking about me. After a while, we might even be willing to admit that, well, okay, alcoholism is a disease. The person we married, this person in our life has this disease. But that won't do it. Until I admitted deep down that I had a disease, these steps could not work for me. Could not work. We will die if we don't admit that the disease is ours. And there's a bridge we need to cross, those of us who are in Al-Anon. Because we come in saying, it's them. I want to get them to stop drinking. And we say, oh, come on in, dear, it's okay. Get them to pray a little bit, kind of show them the steps. They want to talk about them, we kind of steer them away. And we've got to cross a bridge from it's them to it's me. And when we get there, the good news is ours. There is a solution to alcoholism, the family disease, when we admit we have it. There is no solution until we admit that. That's been very important to my recovery. After I left Alateen, I went into Al-Anon, kind of hung around there for a little while. I was kind of like the token guy. I looked at them as my harem. Another guy would come in, you know, I'd say, oh, welcome. Inside, I'm saying, get out. These are my women. True. I honestly did that. And I loved them. They were great. But I wasn't getting any better. And God had a long way to go with me. And it finally happened that, you know, I met her. You all met him, you all met her, it happened. And you know, I got to tell you that I've had, to date, five alcoholics in my life. Two by birth and three by choice. I'll tell you about the first, and of those three by choice, I met two in Al-Anon. So if you happen to be female and in Al-Anon, and are wondering if you might be alcoholic, ignore the 20 questions. simply come up after the meeting and ask me, "Do you find me attractive?" If the answer is yes, run to AA. Surefire. Surefire test right there. I got the alcoholic antenna. I'm not feeling so much buzz here tonight, but when I do these things at AA conferences, I'm kind of going, thousand female alcoholics. They come out and hug me after, "Oh, this is marvelous. God, I have a strange sense of humor. It's amazing." You know, this pathological attraction to female alcoholics. I'm out at these things talking about these alcoholics. It just, it blows my mind. It blows my mind. I love it. How the hell do I get onto that? What are you talking about? Anyhow, when I finished high school, I decided that I wanted to follow a career in music. And so I applied to get got in, and then I wanted to a couple of years later, wanted to do a summer program at a school out in Alberta, Banff. Beautiful little city, town, really. And so I applied, auditioned, got accepted into this program. It was an ensemble program. I played the tuba. And the person who accepted me in said, "Well, look, why don't you contact the four other people, because there's five people in the group, a quintet, and see if you can do some rehearsing before you come out. You'll be a little farther ahead." And so I contacted three of the other four, made arrangements for a rehearsal, and then I found her. I had never met her before. But I'm here to tell you that the antenna worked through phone lines too. And what was supposed to be simply a 5-minute conversation to arrange a rehearsal turned into an hour-long lust fest, never having met. And I was fascinated with this woman, because she had been places that I had never been. And she had done things that I had never done. And she'd been all over. And she had met people I wanted to meet. And she had played music I wanted to play. And it was just an amazing, amazing hook. You know, it was kind of some suction cups, you know, floating around in the room. We just kind of met one another. And on the phone. And so I was a little curious, because I was so attracted to this voice. That's why I'm not online. That's for sure. It's also why I have clear instructions from my sponsor not to sponsor women. I have a female sponsor, and she says to me, "You don't sponsor women." You're right. Actually, the third one of those three, I used to sponsor her. Yeah, that's another story. So anyhow, I started to ask around about Susan and discovered that, she certainly was quite a player and had been around. And I found out also that she was experienced. And I wasn't, at least not with other people. And I was about to discover very soon that it's a hell of a lot more fun with two than it was with one. And so, because I'm sheltered, kind of looking after mom all the time. That was what happened at home, really, for me. And I'm kind of breaking out into the world now, going away to the school. And so this thing happened. We had booked a flight, and we were going to go out to Banff together. But like a week or so before, she phoned me up, and she was drunk. Can you believe that? I was working in the liquor store at the time. Summer job in the liquor store. That's a true story. And she said, "Look, my boyfriend was supposed to come over, and he didn't show up. I drank this bottle of red wine. Why don't you come on over?" My head said, "Rick, that's bad." But something deep down inside went, "Better than I can help you with that." Because you see, these phone calls and these conversations we were having, I discovered that she had been abused. Oh, really? Now, I didn't know I was doing that. But deep down inside, it was like a little Bob Cratchit. Kind of keeping score, keeping check, doing an accounting. Oh, she'd been abused by this one. Oh, really? Is that right? Your brother threw you through a window. Well, is that right? You know, I can help you with that. And then she drinks. So the magic day came, and we were heading off to this school. And there I was sitting in the airport in Toronto. There was no snow that day. And it was a long terminal, and I'm sitting there, and my mother's beside me. Dad's there, sending off their sheltered son. And she came. And she was bouncing.
And she was sparkling.
She was a hell of a lot more exciting than people in Ellen, I'll tell you that. And down she came. And it's just kind of like this. And we watched her. We watched her just kind of come down the terminal. And she stood in front of us. And she had her suitcase with her trumpets in it one hand. And her suitcase with her clothes in it another. And she stood in front of us with this sparkling black hair and this beautiful little blue top. And kind of said, "Hi!" And she kind of bent over and put her stuff down, and my mother kind of looked and went in mild cardiac arrest, and the eyes popped right out of my father's head. And I just kind of looked up to heaven and said, "There is a God." So I've been asking for 10 years. I knew that. And away we went. And we got onto that plane, and we're sitting there, and I ordered a beer, and she ordered a beer, and I was drinking my beer, and she ordered another, and I was drinking my beer, and she ordered another, and she had five. And I want to let you know that you can take it to the bank that she had five. Because if there's anything an Al-Anon knows how to do, it's count. We know. And I'm thinking, now, you know, this part of my head's going, this isn't too good, but there's something inside of me that's beyond my control that was going, "I can help you with that, darling." And the next day I discovered that two was a hell of a lot more fun than one. And it wasn't very intimate, but it was fun. It's funny, you know, how we call that kind of, we call sex intimacy. It's the most unintimate thing in the world. As a matter of fact, it's a way just to not be intimate. But it's always fun. Worst it ever gets is good. I don't know why I just said that. Edit that, Jim. Anyhow, so we'd play music and, you know, we'd have sex, but then we'd have something that was a heck of a lot more exciting. And those of you in Al-Anon who are like me know what that is. Because after we would do all that other stuff, we would sit down and talk. And she would tell me her problems. And I would help her fix them. And I felt wanted. I felt valued. I felt okay. Then a couple of weeks into this, what we call a relationship, I have a friend at home that calls it a parasitic entanglement. She's alcoholic also. I lovingly refer to her as my fourth alcoholic, by choice. And a couple of weeks in, we're sitting in this common room in this school, and she says to me, "You know, Rick, I've been seeing a therapist for an awful long time, but I don't need to see that therapist anymore. Because now I have you." Pull that in. So we talk about this family disease of alcoholism. Alcoholism, the family disease. I'd like to share with you what I believe is that it's a disease and it has symptoms. And some of those, and that's one of them for me. See, I didn't need to be loved. I didn't think at the time I needed to be loved. I did need to be loved, but I needed something more than that. I needed someone to need me so that for a brief moment in time, I could feel I was okay. Because I, like we hear every single person who stands behind one of these microphones, and like every person who shares at a meeting, I am the same. I've got that hole too. Right inside, that storm inside, that God hole, or whatever we want to call it, there's an emptiness, and there's a yearning, and I have it too. And for a brief moment, I felt that I didn't feel that emptiness. I didn't feel that aching pain in my belly that I was weird. And I had this woman on my arm, and I thought, man, I'm just the greatest, because someone needs me. Because you see, friends, how can one be a nothing if someone needs you? And that's what it was for me. Because, you know, we talk about problems. What are the problems of those of us in Al-Anon? You know, well, we politely say we're people pleasers. Heard a guy say it much better one time. He says, "I'm not a people pleaser. I'm an approval sucker." Kind of pull it in, you know, whatever I can get it. You know, and if I found that in this. Another problem we say is we have low sense of self-esteem. Well, no, I don't have low sense of self-esteem. I have no self-esteem. None. And so I look for it all around. That's why I made everybody else my higher power. You know, I kind of switch around to be whatever they wanted me to be. Okay now, can I be with you now? When I was a kid, I took a personality test, and the personality test came back, and the result was, "Rick, you are amorphic." I didn't know what that meant. I asked. They said amorphic means you kind of shape yourself to whatever situation you're in. I said, "Well, gee, that's good, isn't it?" They said, "No, Rick, that means you don't know who you are." It kind of took me back. I didn't like that. See, I'd been an Al-Anon all those years. I thought that I was doing it. What I was doing was I was grooving on fellowship. And fellowship's good. But it's not the program that warnings in the big book. Let's not misplace fellowship or mistake fellowship for the power of program. A lot of power in fellowship, but it doesn't equal the psychic change that we need. And you know, so after a while, you know, I came back from this school with this woman, and this woman needs me, and people are looking at me saying, you know, Rick, what are you doing with this woman? And my answer to them was this: deep down inside, there's a beautiful person, and I'm going to help bring her out. Nothing that Al-Anon likes better than a challenge. The job. It was a relationship. It was a full-time job. It was a parasitic entanglement. But after a while, it's like a dog that caught a car. What do you do when you get it? I'll tell you what you do with it. You keep it, and you go get another one. Because one isn't enough. Now, I wasn't finding another woman. I found it somewhere else. I just finished teacher's college. I found myself sitting in front of a principal of an inner-city school in downtown Toronto. We had this long chat, this interview, and he said these words to me: Rick, we have a lot of very needy students in this school. Brother, I'm the man for you. And he hired me right in the spot. And I moved into that school because he had told me this. He says, you know, Rick, everybody thinks these kids are stupid. Everybody thinks these kids can't do anything. And I went, oh, yeah? Just watch me. And 2 years later, I teach music. And I feel real comfortable with music stands. I'm up on a music thing here. 2 years later, we put on a show, Fiddler on the Roof. The whole deal. Kids singing, band playing, the whole nine yards. 4 nights of a show. And it was great. It really worked out well. And on the Sunday afternoon, well, it was 3 nights in the Sunday afternoon, principal got up in front of this whole room full of people after we had done this show and called me up on stage. In front of everybody, he hugged me, embraced me. And he kind of stepped back, but he kept his hands on my shoulders, one on each side. He looked me straight in the eye, and he said this. He said, Rick, I've made a lot of decisions since I've been the principal of this school, but the best decision I ever made was to hire you. And just pull that in. See, because you see, all the stuff I did with those kids was not for those kids. It was for the greater glory of their teacher. All that mattered was that you looked at me and said, you're great. Because then for a brief moment in time, I could believe that I was okay. And for a brief moment in time, actually that one lasted a little longer. That was a good one. For a moment in time, I could believe that I was okay and the pain went away. But then it came back. And the thing about these pains when they come back is that when you think they're gone, then they come back, they hurt more. And when you're working totally on self, like I was, because I had stopped even attending Al-Anon. And when you're not looking for this solution, and when the problem is powerlessness, when the problem is unmanageability, we got to have a solution. And so the solution to powerlessness is power. The solution to unmanageability is to manage. And if God's not managing it, my ego's managing it. And my ego said, Rick, if you can do more, you'll get more of that feeling, and for a brief moment in time, you'll be okay. And that's what that was for me. And that's one of the symptoms of my disease, alcoholism, the family disease. There was no alcoholic around doing that to me. That's what I mean by I was affected by alcoholism. I am now afflicted with it. And that's why these 12 steps are working for me today. But that's not the only symptom I had. The other one was anger. Anybody here know an angry alcoholic? Any alcoholic know an angry Al-Anon? Any alcoholic ever had a butcher knife stuck up to your throat? How many times in Al-Anon have we heard and laughed at people share about planning their husband's murder? Holding the knife up? I saw that happen in my home. Regularly I saw that happen. We laugh about that all the time in Al-Anon. But what's that about? Because remember, if we're working in an ego world, if we're working in a world totally of self, because that's what it is when I'm not working with God. It's a self world. I need a solution to my problem. And my problem is this. You're it. And when you're gone, I'll be okay. That's what it is. Scary. But it's true. For me, I didn't think I was angry. I kind of, you know, because I'd been around a little while, I kind of, you know, repressed it. You know, we read about anger in the Odad. It says, well, we counted to 10 with the knife in our hand. In my case, it was an axe. Tell you about that later. Or we kind of temper our voice. We speak softly in dulcet tones. I'm going to kill you. But it starts to come out, and that's what happened for me, you see, because I was a terrified human being. I didn't know that I was a terrified human being. But I was holding on to this anger, and every once in a while it would pop out like in an explosion. And so I'm at home one day, and I'm making a fried egg, and I broke a yolk. I reached into that frying pan, I pulled those eggs out, I flung them against the wall, I took the frying pan, bang, 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 on the stove, and I'm there in the kitchen all by myself, and I kind of looked around going, what the hell was that? It surprised me, it really did. And then I'm getting a glass of, not too long after, I'm getting a glass of water out of the cooler in my kitchen, and I just had this feeling, like I wanted to fling it against the wall. And I'm alone, there's nobody around doing this, I'm saying, what is this? Well, you see, you can only stuff for so long, and then it's going to come out. And then I found that I was starting to talk to, you know, I'd be at my Al-Anon meeting, and I was having these really crazy thoughts, like, you know, you'd be talking to me, and we'd be talking about, you know, just something in program, and I'm thinking, you know, I want to smack you right in the mouth. Oh, I'd think that, honest to God, I would. And then I kind of envision it, you know, just kind of, I think, you know, well, geez, if I just go, boom, like this, like that, in the smack. What would that look like? Now, that started to bother me. I'm at a meeting, you know, we're talking about God, and I'm thinking, boom, like that. But then, you know, in the beginning, it wasn't every person. So I started to think, because again, you know, like I'm back to meetings by this time. I divorced that. I married and divorced that woman, by the way. Actually, I married her, she divorced me. That's the true story. Ran off with somebody, can you believe that? Oh, poor me. Anyhow, I'm back to meetings at this time, and I'm sitting there talking about, in a meeting, we had a large group at that time, the group I went to, we had about 80 people, probably not large for Nebraska, at least for this group. This is amazing. Let me just kind of segue over. What I am witnessing here tonight, for an Al-Anon anniversary, A, to be able to bring a speaker from where I live to come to talk to me, is astonishing to me. But B, to see this kind of deal, there's enough food there for another anniversary. But to see you people with a number of AAs joining in, congratulate yourself. This does not happen everywhere. It doesn't. So anyhow, I'm at these meetings, and then I'm thinking, well, maybe it's them, because I'm still operating in a self-world. Even when you're in meetings, you can do that, you know. And then, so I'm thinking, well, they're putting out some kind of karma. You know, it's just one person or another. But then after a while, it started happening to everybody. And then, you see, but I couldn't let it out. And then it inverted. I started wanting to do things to myself. So I'm at a meeting one night. We're talking about step 12. I'm sitting at the back of this large meeting. Two people beside me, boyfriend, girlfriend, start giggling. I'm the group representative at the time. Spiritual giant. Then in Al-Anon, you know, when I came back to Al-Anon, I forgot to mention to them that I had been absent for 3 years. So they say, how long have you been in Al-Anon? Well, you know, 20 years. Kind of forgot to mention that I just stopped. In AA terms, I went out and drank again. But I just forgot those three years. Today, I stand before you and say I have been in Al-Anon continuously for 12 years and 10 months. That's the truth. But I wasn't there at the time. I had program pride. I was hung up on that number. And that these people were starting to giggle. I'm talking about having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And they started laughing, and a rage came out of me in that meeting like I had never seen. And I started screaming and berating these people in my meeting. Would you elect me for GR again if you're going to? It scared me. And afterwards, somebody said, you got to do something about that. That's when I went home and read the ODAP. You know, count to 10, you know, speak in soft dulcet tones. That didn't do it for me. Keep an open mind when I tell you this. It was necessary for me to seek some outside help for my rage problem. Because it was no longer anger. It was rage. I wanted to kill. And it was coming out of me. I held on to it for a long time because I thought it was powerful. Power. It made me feel powerful. It kind of gave me that illusion of power. But it wasn't power. Because what I discovered when I went into therapy is this woman did this thing with me, and after I went through this whole process, which is not appropriate, she said, Rick, you are a dry drunk. You have alcoholic rage. And if you don't do something about it someday, you're going to hurt somebody and be put away for it. And that was the truth. So I had to try to chop up my wife with an axe on a camping trip one time. And I knew she was right. I had never uttered that to another human being. and I knew she was absolutely right. And I started going into this to see a therapist regularly. And every time I walked in, and said, God, that third step thing, you know, take care of me. I believe in being taken care of. And I went and did all this stuff, and you know what I discovered? Underneath the rage, underneath the anger, I discovered terror. And that's when the program started to work for me around that problem. Well, because we know how to deal with fear. Big time, we know how to deal with fear. So what I would like to say to you tonight, based on my experience, is this. That anger and rage is a symptom of terror and fear. And when I start to feel angry, and when I start to feel rageful, I say to myself, what am I afraid of? Because that's what it's about. And Al-Anon will often say, in AA we hear it said too, that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting different results. I challenge that definition. I wasn't doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting a different result. I did it because I wanted that first result, because I felt whole for a brief moment in time. I don't think an alcoholic ever drinks because they want to throw up again. They drink because they want that feeling that we all hear them describe. My definition of insanity is this. When I begin to believe that eliminating you or eliminating me is the solution to my problem, I am in insanity. That's what insanity is for me today. Ending you or ending me. Because you see, anger and rage has two sides. Homicide and suicide. We have to deal with it. That's the second symptom I have. Third one is being a victim. Anybody here victims? I loved being a victim. Total power being a victim. Did you realize that? You accept no responsibility. You don't have to accept any. It was them. How come you like this? I'm 43 years old. I'm a naked alcoholic. Well, that's right. Yeah, that's why you want to kill somebody. That's it. That's for sure. What is it? You know, how come you're this way? She left me. She ran off with somebody else. I'm the victim here.
No.
I'm the volunteer. The sponsor says. Being a victim is a choice and it's an action. And there's no way this program will ever work if I continue to be a victim. When I accept responsibility for my actions, for my thinking, Al-Anon, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous can and do work for me. I was a whining victim. That's the definition of a whine is? Anger escaping through a very small hole. And if you're not a victim, I'll bet you're a martyr. That's the only sign there is. Did you know that a martyr is a victim with a mission? Same thing. Flip side of the coin. There's also a controller, all kinds of other stuff. You know, how long have we been talking? Is it okay? Can I keep going?
No.
Okay, I'll stop. No, I won't. So they're the symptoms. And so what I'm saying is sharing with you tonight, as honestly as I'm able to know how to, is that when I really began to look at my behavior with a lot of help, when I really began to look at what it was that was going on in me, apart and separate from these alcoholics I continued to choose and bring into my life, because there were three of them that I brought in. It was the third one was like it just knocked me out that I actually did that a third time. So my sponsor said, I can't believe this. She said, how does it feel? It feels awful! And then she left and I wanted her back. After all these years, it was weird. Finally, that was over. And I'm currently single. Looking for the... I know. I've been single for 3 years. The first year was an assignment. This is how that came down. This is a confusing story for me in my life. And I kind of had it like interlocking women, you know, because that, you know, because the moon, and they all needed me. Yeah. Oh, it feels so good. You know, I got another one, you know, this one, I feel, this one's kind of drifting away, find another one, you know. I got a hook in with a few overeaters. They're pretty cool, too. And it's the same kind of phobia. It's weird, you know. And when I was one time, and she wouldn't eat all day, and then at night she'd eat 2 pie plates full of food, and then eat a box of fudgicles. I made the mistake one night of asking her for a fudgicle. She almost tore my head up. But she needed me. I was helping her out. Jesus, bizarre. So anyhow, the third one ended, and my sponsor says, it was in August. She said, I want you to be celibate. Because that was the deal, right? You get in, you can't leave. Oh, the sex is so good. The earth moves. That's the worst it ever gets is good. And so she said, why don't you try it for 4 months? And I was at a point where I was finally sick and tired of, you know, because at that time I was 40. I said, like, none of these had worked. Other areas of my life are working. This one's not working. So she said, try 4 months. I said, okay. I have a long-distance relationship with my sponsor. And so I went down to visit her at New Year's, and my 4 months was up on New Year's Eve. So about 6 o'clock on New Year's Eve, I said to her, hey, my time's up tonight. She says, I've been wanting to talk to you about that. I said, I knew you were going to do that. And she says, what do you think about extending it to a year? I said, I think you're right. And I did it. God has extended it to more. Because what I discovered, and what I will share with you now, is that for someone like me, who is addicted to that kind of thing, I discovered that I can have friendships with women without having sex. And that's an amazing thing for a man like me. I've discovered that. I've discovered that it's possible to go friendship, relationship first. And that when you give it time, you may not want to have the relationship. I never knew that. It's kind of like, hi, let's have a relationship. It wasn't like, let's have coffee. It's, hi, let's have a relationship. That's the way it was for me. And so I stopped doing that. And so I don't know how long this is going to continue. And to be honest with you, I'm really quite happy the way things are working out, because I'm discovering I have a lot of female friends. And it's a marvelous, marvelous thing. But anyhow, that was basically the mess I was in when I came back to Al-Anon, but I didn't know I was in that mess. And as you know, Dee, we kind of laughed about it when I came in tonight, you know, like, how long have you been in Al-Anon? Well, I've been in this long, but I've really only been doing it for about 6 years. I agree with that. Because we can be in here for a long time. And it took me all that time, I'll tell you, to cross the bridge. It really did. It took me all that time to stop blaming them, to say, look, Rick, it's you. Accept that. My sponsor said, I also had to accept the fact that it's too late to have a happy childhood. But it's never too late to have a happy life. What a great thing. Because I was holding on to that. It's never too late to have a happy life. And we can have one here. We see, look at the smiles. Look at the, listen to the laughter. Just feel the energy in this room. Here we all are. It's never too late to have a happy life. And so, here's the deal for me. I'm going to these meetings, I'm hearing people talk, and I didn't have a sponsor. And I was embarrassed about that. I hear people talk about getting a sponsor and having the sponsor walk me through the steps, and I wanted that. But I was too afraid or too egotistical or too whatever, arrogant, to really ask anybody. And it took a long time for me to be beaten down before I could finally say, will you be my sponsor? And I asked a fellow to do it. His name was Bob. And I asked him, and he helped me out for a while. And then, you know, he moved away. I lent him some money. He didn't give me the money back. And it caused a real, it drove a real wedge between us. And I was without a sponsor again. And I started to pray about that. And I stopped being ashamed about it. And I started to share about that. I said, I need a sponsor. And to be honest with you, I don't know who to ask. I really don't. Because then so I kind of gave God some directions about sponsorship. Well, you know, because in a pamphlet that says, you know, men sponsor men and women sponsor women. Well, it might be different in Bellevue, but in Toronto, there's not a hell of a lot of men in Al-Anon. And so I'm looking around for a man who's kind of been, you know, longer time than me, active in service. And I gave all these definitions, and there really wasn't anybody. And there's one guy I thought of. I phoned him up, and he said, gosh, Rick, it's good to hear from you. You know, I haven't been to a meeting for a long time. And, well, you know, you're not going to be my sponsor. So if you're interviewing, or if you're thinking of someone to ask to be a sponsor, here are the three questions you ask, if you don't already know the answers. The first one is, do you have a home group? If the answer is no, there are no other questions. The second question is, if the answer is yes to the first one, the second question is, do you have a sponsor? And if the answer is no, there's no third question. But if the answer is yes, then the third question is, not will you be my sponsor. If you will be my sponsor, I will do absolutely anything you ask me to do. That's how I get it. And I think that's why it's worked, because I was finally at a point. And I want to tell you how I met my sponsor. Like I said, I was praying about this because that guy, you know, didn't work out, and I'd given God these directions, and a friend of mine at home, she was hosting a speaker who had come to town, and she introduced me to this person. After the Friday night meeting at this conference, these two friends, you know, my friend and the speaker came and said, hey, we're looking for a Dairy Queen. Why don't we go out? I said, look, there's a better place to go. So we went out, and we sat down, and it happened. You know that connection? When you meet someone and you just know that there's something very, very special there, but words don't. You can't write it. You can't articulate it, but you just know. We had a great chat. Saturday she did her talk, and after her talk, she came to get me and said, let's go get more ice cream. Little did I know, she was kind of doing the pre-sponsor. You know, a good sponsor kind of hovers. I ask you a question, you know, let you answer it, sink yourself in, and they die in the carrier. Get you, tear you apart. And so this is her pre-sponsorship thing. I see it now. So we're walking along the street in Toronto, and she says, well, tell me about yourself. And I said, well, you know, I tried to chop my wife's head off with an axe on a camping trip. And she laughed. She's like, you. And I felt comfortable doing that because she just finished sharing a story about how she had tried to drown her husband in a bathtub. And I realized later on that in my list of requirements for sponsorship, I forgot to include potential murderer. And she laughed, and we bonded, and it happened for me. And so we had a great night, and then she went home, and a few days later, my friend and I are going to a retreat in Missouri, and my friend looks over to me and says, have you found a sponsor yet? I said, no. She said, yes, you have. I said, it's too crazy. She said, let's pray about that. And each day, her and I prayed together. Is this the right thing for Rick to do? And on the Thursday night of the retreat, it was in Missouri. Thursday night of the retreat, I sat in a chapel, and I wrote the most honest letter I had ever written in my life. And I said this. I said, I am sick to death of doing this by myself. I really enjoyed meeting you. I want what you have. And if you will be my sponsor, I will do anything you ask me to do. I sealed it and I sent it. 10 days later, I got a package. And I said, well, it's either a really long forget it, pal, or I'm in. Opened up the package. There was a lovely letter. She said, you know, I really enjoyed meeting you too, and on and on and on. You know, said I wasn't going to do anywhere long distance sponsorship, but the bottom line is, it's a legitimate Al-Anon request. She had talked to her husband. Her husband said, hey, why not? And she said, so, welcome to the family. And I started to cry. Because you see, friends, I had been in this. I had been around this for a long time, but in my arrogance, I had never allowed myself to be in. And finally, I was willing to be in. And that's about the last nice thing she said to me for about a year. I'll tell you that. But I started phoning regularly, and this is what she told me to do. And she told me to do what I see you people do here in Nebraska. It has some structure. It has some guidelines. It has some commitment. It has discipline to it. And I am a fundamentally an undisciplined, pleasure-seeking human being. I will do what I want, when I want to do it. I'm a procrastinator. Thus, I have a slug. Procrastinators do whatever they want. They always do the pleasure thing first. Not the hard thing. I always do the pleasure thing first. That's what I was doing. She said, you will do it. And man, I need this. She said, this is how you will do the steps. You know, read all these books. She'll answer these questions. She'll share these answers. And this is what we did. How do you do step one? You just sit around on a couch and say, I admit. It never worked for me. This is what I did. She said, read everything about step one in every one of these books. Answer these 12 questions. One of the questions was, have you truly admitted that alcoholism is a family disease, and as such, it's a disease you've got? Oh. My honest answer was, no, I haven't, but I need to do that. So I challenge you to try this. Take out all your Al-Anon literature. Don't read a book at a time. Read only about one step in all the books, and you'll find the thread. because that's what happened to me. You'll find the thread about powerlessness, about unmanageability, about what this family disease is. And I shared these answers with my sponsor, and she said these magic words to me. Rick, you have done step one to the best of your ability today. Move on. I'll say that again. Move on. I was a spinner, stuck over and over and over and over and over again. And finally to have somebody say, move on. It's like a breath of fresh air. And I did the same with two, with three, with four. Of course, she gave me this big inventory. I wrote it out, went down to see her. Did my fifth step. It took 2 days. And she sat there and listened to everything, 110 pages. It wasn't perfect, but I'll tell you, it was complete. She said that to me when it was done. She said, well, it sure was thorough. You bet. I've been here a long time. And when I sat there to do that step, I said, I need to be able to say this one thing when it's finished. I need to be able to say this. There's nothing that I've left off. Nothing. And when I was finished, I could say that. And what she told me to do when I was writing my fourth step was she said at the top of the page, put, God loves you. At the bottom of the page, put, God still loves you. And that was more important to me than anything. Because I did it on a computer. And so the God still loves you was always there, no matter what I wrote. And as I dug deep down in, and you may, if you've done it, you know what it is. There are things that you, I wouldn't even let them into my consciousness. Never mind utter them to another human being. But I knew I needed to clean them out because I was dirty inside. And if I didn't do it, I was never going to meet God. I knew it. And so I put it out and I read it to her, and when we were done, she said, let's go. And we went out into her backyard and we lit a fire. And with each page, we stood there together and said a prayer. God, let us move from the old into the new with you as the guide. And I watched all of that stuff burn. And when we went back inside, I said to her, there's nothing I haven't told you. And she looked at me and said this. She said, Rick, I love you more. Because I know you better. Ladies and gentlemen, my deepest fear was that if you knew me, you would loathe me. And what I discovered in taking the actions of these steps is quite the opposite. That when you know me, you love me more. And I found that I always wanted to go there. I always wanted to get to the light, but I was walking that way. Because I was walking in a way of self. Myself, I never said, tell somebody everything. That never crossed my mind to do that. Tell everybody to put it all out to somebody. But when I told it, it's like somebody, like God grabbed me and kind of pushed me like this. And said, Rick, do the things you don't want to do, because that's how you're going to get where you want to go. And that's what I discovered. And as I worked through those steps, I continued to find that. And then it became lazy, and I got a slug. But I can say to you today, that it's been a long time since I felt like smashing anybody in the face. I can say this, and that's a wonderful thing. I haven't picked up an axe for a long time. And that's a great thing. Because the real wonderful stories of Al-Anon are the stories of recovery. And of doing the deal. And of taking action against our thinking so that we can get to the place we've always wanted to go. I'm going to end. As you can imagine, I had a difficult relationship with my father. Very difficult. Even after he stopped drinking, it was, I never felt like a man when I was with my dad. I felt like this little kid looking for his approval and all that stuff. But as I started to grow, as I started to come to know me more from working these steps and working them with another person, not doing it alone. I think, you know why in Al-Anon we don't have a founder? You know why AA doesn't have a founder? Because by the very definition is that we have to do this with another person. The seminal moment in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous is not when Bill saw the white light. It's when he met Bob in that gatehouse. That's the genesis. And we don't really know what happened in that gatehouse, but we do know this. And on February 19th, 2000, here we are together in Bellevue, Nebraska. And all those years ago, they met. But it was two. And when I was here doing this thing, one, I wasn't doing it. I had to do it with two. And as I started doing it with her, and I'm really sharing with others and working with other people, I sponsor other guys, I started to realize I made a choice that I wanted to have a relationship with my father. I wanted it. And if that was going to happen, I was going to need to take some action. I was going to need to make some amends, but I was going to living amends we make to parents. Not just go out and say, I'm sorry for being an idiot. That just doesn't cut it. Matter of fact, an amend has nothing to do with saying I'm sorry. It's doing something. And so we like to do outdoor stuff. And so we'd take a few little canoe trips. There's a lot of places to do that where I live. And then I really got the fever and said, this has to work. And so being Al-Anon, it kind of goes from 0 to 100 overnight. I said, you know, Dad, let's take a really good trip. A 14-day trip. And we're going to go so far north that the sun doesn't set. He said, gee, that's a good idea. So it was 4 flights in. The last one was like the canoe was strapped to the plane. It landed on the water, took everything off, flew away. Well, said 14 days that way and flew away. And there we were. Most beautiful country you've ever seen in your life. It was my dad and I, another fellow, and a guide. Now this was like a 14-day trip, 7 days of really still water, 7 days of water like you can't believe, 4-foot waves. And so in the first 7 days, now I haven't done a lot of that kind of canoeing, but I was brave. So in the first 7 days, the guide was to teach us some of how to do it. He was like the river sponsor. Now, you know, now I hadn't lived with my dad for a long time, but I wanted to bond. I'll tell you, you know, you can bond when you're in a canoe, when you're in a tent, when you're by the campfire, when there's nobody else around. Boy, you bond big time. And there's all kinds of things that started to go on that I didn't like. And he was talking about the war all the time. He was getting angry. And then I'm going, oh, my God, I'm sorry, I like this. But then the guide started teaching us this technique on the river. And what happens, because it's a fast-flowing river. And an essential thing to know when you're in a canoe is how to stop. You need to know how to get out. And you don't have to stop because the boat will go away. So you need to make this turn. It's called an eddy turn. And so you're going down the river, and you do these set of maneuvers, and then you make a complete 180-degree turn, and you kind of float over to the shore. It's an amazing thing. And so the guide taught us how to do this. Dad's in the back, the control position. I'm at the front. And so the control position, you know, he tells you what to do. And so the first few times, it's okay, tell me what to do. That's all right! Well, by the 10th time, I'm starting to feel, gee, I don't like this too much, but what do? Push it down, right? Well, by the 20th time, I'm really starting to feel it. And I'm getting pissed. But I'm not saying anything. I'm saying, you know what, Dad, I know how to make the eddy turn. I didn't say that. I just kind of went, And I'm listening to him talk about the war and getting angry, and it's starting to boil. I'm starting to bubble, you know? Now, this is supposed to be the trip of a lifetime. We're in the most beautiful scenery you've ever seen in your whole life. And on the 7th day, he told me how to make the eddy turn, and I absolutely lost it. Screamed at him, I know how to make the goddamn eddy turn, and looked back at him, he was shocked. Where did that come from? Like out of nowhere. And then, Brother Joe, to help me, stop trying to goddamn help me. And I lost it. There was no phone around, there was no sponsor around. You know, I looked at my old app, there's no eddy turn in the back of the damn old app. What do I do? You know? And I lost God. I lost God. And I was totally in the air. So for the rest of the time, you know, in this water where, well, like there's, the water was so high that you had to put a skirt over the canoe, like over the top of the canoe. It's like a two-man kayak. So you go over one wave and through the next one. Kind of boosh in the water. It was amazing, actually. And so the trip ends and I get home and, you know, phone my sponsor and she says, how was the trip? And I went into a rant. He did this, he did that, he was telling me to make a turn, on and on and on and on and on and on and on. I stopped for a breath and she chimed in and says, Rick, what was good about the trip? She heard what you're hearing right now. And I said, I don't know. She gave me an assignment. Good sponsors give assignments. She said, next week, you will come back with a list of good things. So I sat, you know, all week thinking I want to do this damn assignment. Monday night after college, God, I can't phone her without having this assignment done. And so I sat down. And it's amazing when we put pencil to paper. It's amazing! And it started to come out. You know, my dad helped me with the cost of the trip. That was a good thing. My father was 60 years old. And he was in better shape than I was, taking us on a trip like that. My father knew more about the plant life, about the geography, than the guide. He was teaching the guide. What was in the guide? He'd been down the river 20 times. My dad was teaching him. And then another thing came out. Isn't it amazing what we forget when we're blinded by ourselves? I'm afraid of heights. One of the activities on the trip was to take a climb up a mountain. After lunch, the guide said, let's go up the mountain. Okay. Get halfway up the mountain. We stopped to look around. They all say, man, isn't this great? I'm thinking, too far, Bunky. You blew it here. So they just, after the break, they start walking up, and they said, "Well, you coming?" And I looked at my dad, and I said, "No, I think I got to go down." And there's this magic moment. And he looked at the other two who were walking up, and he looked at me, and he said, "I'm going to go down with Rick." And what he did was he eked out a little path. He said, "Rick, come on down this way." And when I got there, he went down a little further. He said, "Rick, come on down this way." And he did that all the way down the mountain. My father led me down the mountain. I had forgotten about that. When I wrote that down, I started to cry. I found my sponsor and I said, "Here are the things." I read them off and she said, "Now you will write a letter." I said, "Do I have to mail it?" She said, "Yes, you do." And I did. So I wrote my dad a letter. I said, "Dear Dad, thank you for the trip of a lifetime. Thank you for helping me with some of the costs. I'm so proud of you for what you know. Thank you for giving me a love for the outdoors. And Dad, thanks for helping me come down the mountain without making fun of me, without making a scene. Thanks for helping me down because I'm afraid of heights." And I read it to my sponsor, and then I mailed it. And as I was walking to the mailbox, I had the feeling of doing the deal. Because unless he was going to die within 3 days, he was going to get it. I wasn't writing that letter and bringing it to a grave site to bury. I wasn't stuffing it inside a coffin. He was going to get it. And I thought, this is the action of recovery. I'm not sitting around thinking this. I'm acting this. Not by myself, on the direction of someone else. I sent it away 3 days later on a Monday morning. It was the summertime. I was off work. He phoned me up, and he had been crying. And he said, "Son, I got your letter." He said, "Rick, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever received in my life." He said, "This is a keeper. Whenever I'm feeling down, I'm just going to take this out and have a read of it." And I said, "Dad, I really love you." And he said, "Son, I really love you too." And that was the beginning of a real close relationship with my dad, based on actions that I wouldn't have taken without the direction of someone else. Then a year ago Easter, I went up to see him. We went out for dinner. I ordered a ginger ale, and he ordered a beer. I was stunned. He said, "This must surprise you." "No shit. What are you doing?" "Well, I read in the Financial Post that a drink a day is good for you." I am powerless over alcohol, insidious as it is. The new journey for me is to continue to be the son I want to be to my father, regardless of the condition of his disease. Because you see, when I was in Alateen, they said to me, "Rick, if your father had a heart problem, would you still love him or would you hate him? Would you stay, would you be with him or would you leave him? If your father had cancer, what would you do, Rick?" "My father is an alcoholic. He has a disease. What do I do?" It is up to me to do a relationship with my father, regardless of the condition of his disease. And that's a great thing for me to know. There's a church in England, St. Paul's, a marvelous painting that hangs high up in the wall. Picture of a traditional robed figure standing with its right hand raised, knocking on the door of an old English cottage. Up in the top corner of the picture it says, "The light of the world." The figure is holding a lantern in its left hand. Underneath is written this inscription, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and have supper with him and he with me." And as every one of us knows, when we look at the picture, there's no doorknob on the outside of the door. Because it is our job to open the door to let God in. I had a privilege of talking in Southern California a couple of years ago. And at their conference, I witnessed this amazing thing. At the end of every meeting, they stood up and they said, let us have a moment of silence before we say the Lord's Prayer. And when the moment of silence was ended, we heard this. We heard the knock every meeting. And then together we said, Our Father. And we opened the door and allowed Him in. And that's my challenge each and every day. My dear friends, the only message I really believe I've learned in Al-Anon is this one. I need to take action against my thinking. My best thinking got me into Al-Anon. I cannot think my way into good action. I absolutely must act my way into good thinking. I must, as my sponsor says, do the deal. Thanks for inviting me to Bellevue. God bless.